Today we're going to be going through the Bible study, Deuteronomy chapter 10 through 12. But before we do that, let's do a review from the last time. And we went through Deuteronomy chapter 7 through 9. And first of all, we covered chapter 7. Review from the last time. Deuteronomy chapter 7 was talking about the test of Israel's commitment to God. And God assured the Israelites that he would deliver the Canaanites over to them and conquer them. And the reason that he was going to do that was for their sin and wickedness. So remember, the Canaanites were strong warrior-type people. They had fortified cities. But God told Israel, don't worry about that. I'm going to give them over to you. You'll conquer them. And the reason why is because of their wickedness. He also warned Israel not to intermarry with the Canaanites because they would turn them, Israel, away to serving their gods, the pagan gods. So God warned them about that also. And also that Israel was to destroy their idols and places of worship. Then we covered briefly, or in this review briefly, we looked at chapter 8 the last time. In chapter 8, we talked about the fact of Israel's need to understand their dependence upon God. With their going into the promised land and a land that was unknown to them, they had to totally trust and depend upon their great God. And there was two ways that they would do that. First of all, remember God from their past, all the mighty works that he had done for them, releasing them from the slavery of Egypt by the plagues and all, taking care of them in the desert. And also, besides remembering God from the past, they should not forget God when they come into the land. God would bless them in the land, and he warned them not to forget God when they came into the land of Canaan. And in the last part of chapter 8, it was emphasized that the blessings and abundance in the land would be from God, not from their own power and might, but from God. Then the next chapter that we covered the last time was chapter 9. And chapter 9 dealt with lessons from the wilderness wandering, the wilderness traveling. And again, God gave admonition to Israel not to be afraid of the stature of the people. And if you remember the account from Numbers in chapter 13 and 14, when the spies were sent into the land, they brought back a bad report. There's giants in the land. There's fortified cities. And God was giving admonition to the new generation, don't worry about that. Don't be afraid of the stature of the people, that God would drive them out because of their wickedness. Also, when we talk about lessons from the wilderness wandering, we talked about the fact that God was reflecting in the sermon that Moses was giving, reflecting upon departing from God at the golden calf incident. Moses, upon seeing Israel sin when they formed the golden calf and was worshiping it, he broke the two tablets of the covenant that symbolized the breaking of the covenant between God and Israel. But after that, Moses intervened by fasting and prayer on behalf of Israel. And because of his intervention, the fasting and prayer, God did have mercy upon them. And the last section of chapter 9 that we dealt with last time had Moses' prayer of intercession for Israel. We're going to go through that now. Chapter 9, verses 24 through 29, because this is Moses' prayer of intercession for Israel at the golden calf incident. And the reason that why I'm going through this is because this connects with chapter 10. It actually, probably the chapter should have started here, in my opinion, but that's not the way our King James translator set it up. So the last part of chapter 9 connects with chapter 10. So here it is, verse number 24 of chapter 9. You have been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you. Then in verse 25, Moses says this. Thus I prostrated myself before the Lord, prayed before God, in other words. 40 days and 40 nights. I kept prostrating myself because the Lord had said he would destroy you. And had not Moses intervened in prayer and fasting for Israel, God might have destroyed Israel because of their sin. Verse 26. Therefore I prayed to the Lord and said, O Lord God, do not destroy your people and your inheritance, whom you have redeemed through your greatness, whom you have brought out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Verse 27, remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Do not look on the stubbornness of this people or on the wickedness of their sin. Verse 28, lest the land from which you brought us out should say, because the Lord was not able to bring them to the land which he promised them, and because he hated them, he has brought them out to kill them in the wilderness. The other nations could possibly say this, including Egypt. Verse 29, yet they are your people and your inheritance, whom you brought out by your mighty power and by your outstretched arm. So again, this was Moses, in short form, the prayer of intercession for Israel. Now that brings us now to chapter 10. Chapter 10, and the first part of this chapter, verses 1 through 11, goes through the renewal of the covenant after the golden calf incident. Remember, when Moses came down from the mountain, he broke the two tablets, symbolizing the breaking of the covenant. But after that incident in Moses' prayer, God did renew the covenant with Israel. And that's what's talked about here at the beginning of chapter 10. And the lessons for the new generation to learn from this. Okay, so now we come to verse number 1. At that time, Moses says, now this was, at that time is referring to his prayer of intercession for the people that we just read. At that time, the Lord said to me, hold for yourself two tablets of stone like the first, and come up to me on the mountain and make yourself an ark of wood. So God was giving Moses an invitation to come back up on Mount Sinai so that the covenant could be renewed. Verse number 2, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which you broke, and you shall put them in the ark. Verse 3, so I made an ark of acacia wood, hold two tablets of stone like the first, and went up the mountain having the two tablets in my hand. Again, we're talking about the renewal of the covenant process now. Now let's go back to verse number 1, and we see this phrase here where God invited Moses to come up to the mountain. As I mentioned, this was an invitation to renew the covenant. Then in the last part of verse number 1, we see this phrase, make yourself an ark of wood. Now this wasn't told in the Exodus account in Exodus chapter 34, but it is being told here in Deuteronomy chapter 10 to the new generation. And despite Israel's sin, and because of Moses' prayer of on behalf of Israel, God was going to be merciful to them. So he says, make yourself an ark of wood. Now, the Understanding Bible Commentary series adds this. Moses is speaking here as the initiator behind the making of the ark by a craftsman. Remember, it was an individual called Bezalel that actually made the ark. But Moses was the one that authorized it. And that's what he is saying here, where I made an ark. He actually was the one that authorized it. And that, I have that in the next frame here, where we see in verse number 3 this phrase, so I made an ark of acacia wood. In word commentary, to say that Moses made the ark means that he had it made under his authority to contain the stone tablets on which God had written the 10 words, the 10 commandments. So when Moses said, I made the ark, he meant I was the one that authorized the ark to be made where the two tablets would be put within. Then continuing on, we come to verse number 4. And he wrote on the tablets according to the first writing. God wrote on the tablets, according to the first writing, the 10 commandments, which the Lord had spoken to you in the mountain, talking about Mount Sinai, from the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly. And the Lord gave them to me. Verse 5. Then I turned and came down from the mountain, and put the tablets in the ark, which I had made, which he had authorized to be made. And there they are, just as the Lord commanded me. And when he says, there they are, the two tablets in the commandment, he's talking about a demonstration that the covenant has been renewed between God and Israel. Now, going back to verse number 4, we see the phrase, the Ten Commandments, which is our English wording, Ten Commandments. In the literal Hebrew, it's the Ten Words. And it appears twice in the book of Deuteronomy, what we're reading here in chapter 10, but also in chapter 4, verse 13. And it's translated into English, the Ten Commandments. Also in verse number 4, we see the phrase, He wrote, God wrote, according to the first writing, like the first tablets that had been written. Here's a very good comment from the Nelson Study Bible, very appropriate. It says this, The Lord did not add to or take away from the commandments. Nothing was changed. I think that's quite significant because 40 years had virtually gone by from the time that had been given in the first tablets had been given in Mount Sinai. And now the new generation is receiving the tablets again with a renewed covenant. But the commandments stay the same, including the Sabbath commandment, which most people like to do away with. Continuing on now, we see here that the writing of the Ten Commandments and their storage in the Ark was a tangible sign of the renewed covenant between God and Israel. It was the demonstration of that renewal of the covenant. And in verse 5, Moses says, And I put the tablets in the ark which I had made. Comment from the Understanding Bible Commentary Series. Having the commandments in the ark in the midst of the people was symbolic of the nearness of God again. Okay? God had distanced himself from Israel because of the golden calf incident. But now he was close to them again. And again, very significant because they needed God's presence with them. The next section that we come to now, verses 6 through 9, is a historical note. And we can see that by the way it begins with a parenthesis at the beginning of verse number 6. But this historical note that we're going to read shows that Moses' intervention of prayer for Israel was successful. And that Aaron and Israel journeyed on in their journey from Mount Sinai towards the Promised Land. So verse number 6, and again you can see that there's a parenthesis at the beginning of verse number 6 showing that this was a historical note. Now the children of Israel journeyed from the wells of Benajachin to Mosera, where Aaron died and where he was buried. And Eleazar his son ministered as priest in his stead. Now this tells us in this note in verse number 6 that Aaron wasn't killed. Even though he was the one that fashioned, remember, the golden calf that Israel worshipped when Moses was up on Mount Sinai, God allowed him to continue on with his life until they reached Mount Hor, where he did die. So they journeyed on in their journey. Verse number 7. From there they journeyed to Gadgada, and from Gadgada to Jotbatha, a land of rivers of water. Verse number 8. Moses says this, at that time, and he's referring to the time of his intercessory prayer again. At that time, the Lord separated the tribe of Levi to bear the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, to stand before the Lord, to minister to him, and to bless his name to this day. At that time, after Moses' prayer of intercession, remember Moses said in the Exodus account, Whoever is on the Lord's side, come to me. And the tribe of Levi came forward, faithfully came forward. And because of that faithfulness, they were made in charge of the ark, the ministry, etc. Continuing on, verse number 9. Therefore, Levi has no portion nor inheritance with his brethren because their service was for God in the tabernacle and eventually the temple. The Lord is his inheritance, just as the Lord your God promised him. Verse number 10, As at the first time, I stayed in the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. The Lord also heard me at that time, and the Lord chose not to destroy you. Again, Moses fasting and praying for 40 days and 40 nights, intercession for Israel. Verse 11, Then the Lord said to me, Arise, Begin your journey before the people, that they may go in and possess the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. And verse 11 is telling them that God had mercy upon Israel, allowed them to continue on in their journey. He is near to them again. The covenant has been renewed. Again, going back to what had happened at Mount Sinai. Okay, in verse number 8, we see that the tribe of Levi was set apart because Moses called for them to come forward, and they did. And they were set apart in three ways. First of all, to carry the Ark of the Covenant. Secondly, to minister before God. And thirdly, to praise His name. And that's what Levi was set apart to do. But they had no inheritance in the land. In verse number 10 and 11, talking about because of Moses' intercession that Israel was able to continue their journey, the New International Commentary of the Old Testament adds this: the concluding verse of this section emphasizes that Moses' prayer had been answered. The people had not been destroyed, and the covenant relationship between God and His people was still intact only through the grace of God. Now, we're reading through this particular history about what happened with Israel, and Moses is giving this to the new generation, but this has meaning for us as well here in the year 2020, for all of us as brethren in the church. Because we can understand and we can realize that we make mistakes, we are sinners, but if we go before God asking for repentance and coming before Him with the right attitude and the right heart, God will forgive us, just as He did Israel and allowed them to continue on with their journey. So this is important material for us as well. Okay, continuing on, in the next section, the next section is Moses' address about God's requirement of the people. Okay, they had learned the lessons from the golden calf incident. Now, what does God require of them? And that's what's talked about in this next section. Verse number 12. And now, Israel, again after learning the lessons, what does the Lord God require of you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all His ways, and to love Him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Verse number 13, and to keep the commandments of the Lord and His statutes, which I command you today for your good. Verse 14, indeed heaven and the highest heavens belong to the Lord your God. God is the supreme creator of all, in other words. Also the earth with all that is in it. Verse 15. The Lord delighted only in your fathers to love them, and He chose their descendants after them, you above all the peoples as it is this day. Again, they had learned lessons from the golden calf incident. So the question was, what does the Lord your God require of you? And we read what it says here in verse number 12. There's also a companion verse in Micah chapter 6, verse number 8, which I have on the screen, which Micah spoke to the people of his day and time. And it says in verse number 8 of Micah chapter 6, He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? But to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. So again, learn the lessons, but there are things that we need to do as individuals as well. Fear God, walk in His ways, keep His commandments. Verse number 14 stressed the sovereignty of God over everything created in the universe. And in verse number 15, it explains that He chose their descendants, the descendants of Israel, after them above all peoples. The New International Commentary of the Old Testament adds this: against the background of God's universal sovereignty, the election of His people in love is expressed. And that's what God was showing them, and that He would take care of them. Verse number 16. Therefore, circumcise the foreskin of your heart and be stiff-necked no longer. Again, this is a lesson to be learned for the people of Israel. Now, circumcision, this is a metaphor. The metaphor of circumcision symbolizes the covenant relationship between God and Israel. But here, it's being used in spiritual applications. Circumcision was a physical act, but it's expressed here in spiritual applications. A change of heart. Change of heart and be stiff-necked no longer. Verse 17, for the Lord your God is a God of gods and Lord of lords. He's the supreme ruler, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality nor takes a bribe. He's the righteous judge, in other words. Okay, we talked about circumcision symbolizing the covenant relationship. Here's a very good comment from the Nelson Study Bible. It says this, circumcision was a physical sign of the covenant. Faith and repentance were spiritual signs. Since the Canaanite worship system involved sexual excess, the distinctive sign of the body of the male Hebrew would be a significant reminder not to participate in the rituals of the Canaanites. But circumcision was to be done within as well as without. Marking the body as a sign of dedication to the Lord is unimportant unless there is a change of heart. The covenant administered by Moses required a spiritual change. So it goes much deeper than just the physical circumcision that would be done by Israel. A change of heart is required by God. A change of attitude is something that we should reflect as well. Going back to verse number 17, we see this term, the Lord your God is a God of gods and a Lord of lords. This is a very significant phrase here, what we see here in verse 17. This is the basis for a proper attitude towards God that's described in this phrase and his character. Here's some comments from some commentaries. Notice this, from the New International Commentary of the Old Testament. The Hebrew of this phrase employs a superlative construction, so the sense is the supreme God and the absolute Lord. Again, from the Hebrew construction. The Jewish Study Bible Tanakh translates this phrase, God supreme and Lord supreme. And Word Commentary adds this, the statement, which implies the kingship of God in the absolute sense, may be the ultimate source of the phrase Lord of Lords and King of Kings in Revelation 17, verse 14. So you know that phrase in Revelation 17, 14, where it says Lord of Lords and King of Kings. Perhaps it comes back to this particular phrase that we're reading in Deuteronomy. In the last part of verse number 17, where it says, who shows no partiality nor takes a bribe, God is is a righteous judge. And human judges were also to have that same kind of quality. In other words, reflect God's way of life. And we talked about that earlier in chapter 1. Verse number 18. He administers justice for the fatherless and the widow. Loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Verse 17. 19. Therefore love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Reflecting God's character, God cares for the fatherless, the widow, the stranger. And we should reflect that type of attitude as well. Verse number 20. You shall fear the Lord your God. You shall serve him, and to him you shall hold fast, and take oaths in his name. Taking oaths in his name is talking about allegiance to him. We talked about this earlier, that when Israel, the new generation, would be going into the promised land and running into all of these pagan deities and gods, that they were not to give oaths or allegiance to the pagan gods. Their oath and their allegiance was to be to God only. And this has been emphasized before in Deuteronomy. Verse 21, he is your praise and he is your God, who has done for you these great and awesome things which your eyes have seen. You know, not only the plagues on Egypt, but taking care of them throughout the desert wanderings. Verse 22, your fathers went down to Egypt, the forefathers, with 70 persons. And now the Lord your God has made you as the stars of heaven in multitude. fulfillment of the promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that they would become like the stars of heaven, a multitude of peoples. And as they were listening to this sermon from Moses, the new generation, I imagine they were looking out at the huge crowd and realizing, yes, God did fulfill the promises that he made, and we are a multitude of people. Going back to verse number 18, a description of God's way of life. Justice for the fatherless and the widow, loving the stranger, giving him food and clothing, which we should do as brethren as well. And in verse number 19, that God's people are to reflect that same way of life, and to remember how that the new generation, to remember how that they were aliens in Egypt. We talked about in verse number 20, this phrase, take oaths in his name, is an oath of allegiance or loyalty only to God in worship. And this was impressed upon the new generation as they would go into the promised land. And in verse number 22, the last part, we see this phrase, God has made you as the stars of heaven in multitude. And as I mentioned, this was a fulfillment of the promise made to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, going back to the book of Genesis, that they were to be, that from their descendants would come a multitude of people. That brings us to the end of chapter 10. Let me take a quick drink of water here, and we'll move into chapter 11. Chapter 11 ends the first part of Moses' second sermon that began in chapter 4, verse 44, which was the introduction to the Ten Commandments for the new generation. So this ends the first part of Moses' second sermon. And this will continue on to chapter 26. In this particular chapter, the emphasis is given to the new generation on choice, the blessing or the cursing for the choice that they would make, that God would bless them for obedience, but cursing for disobedience. Verse number 1. Therefore, you shall love the Lord your God and keep his charge, his statutes, his judgments, and his commandments always. Know today, verse 2, that I do not speak with your children who have not known and who have not seen the chastening of the Lord your God, his greatness and his mighty hand and outstretched arm. Verse 3, his signs and his acts, which he did in the midst of Egypt, to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to all his land. Verse 4, what he did to the army of Egypt, to their horses and their chariots, how he made the waters of the Red Sea overflow them as they pursued you, and how the Lord has destroyed them to this day. Verse 5, what he did for you in the wilderness until you came to this place, a review of how God took care of Israel in the past. Verse 6, and what he did to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, the son of Reuben, how the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, their households, their tents, and all the substance that was in their possession in the midst of all Israel. Verse 7, but your eyes have seen every great act of the Lord which he did. So a contrast is being drawn in this particular section. In verses 1 through 5, the how God took care of Israel and was with them and the mighty acts that he performed. But how, when people disobeyed him, they were cursed. And that's what happened to Dathan and Abiram and the sons of Eliab with that incident that took place going back to Numbers chapter 16. So here in verses 1 through 7, the call to obedience is illustrated by two examples from Israel's past. The positive one, God's deliverance, verses 1 through 5. And the negative one, with Dathan and Abiram's rebellion, verse number 6. And the purpose of going through this history was that the new generation has to make their choice and reap the consequences of that choice. And that's what Moses is teaching, inspired by God, to the new generation. Whatever choice you make, you're going to be blessed for obedience, cursed for disobedience. That brings us now to verse number 8. In this section, verses 8 through 12, that the right choice will result in blessings from God that he would give them. Verse number 8. Therefore you shall keep every commandment which I command you today, that you may be strong and go in and possess the land which you cross over to possess. Verse 9, and that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord swore to give to your fathers, to them and to their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. Verse 10, for the land which you go in to possess is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and watered it by foot as a vegetable garden. Now here, watering it by foot is referring to the irrigation that was done from the river Nile. The Egypt depended upon the river of Nile. It was a desert area. They did not receive a lot of rain. But they had their irrigation canals from the river Nile, and that's how they took care of their crops. And that's what Moses is referring to here. Verse number 11. But the land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, notice this, which drinks water from the rain of heaven. The land of Canaan, the promised land, would and does depend on the rains. There is no major rivers in that particular land. Verse 12, a land for which the Lord your God cares. The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it, from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year. So we see here in this particular section, and especially in verse number 8 and 9, that Moses stresses to the children of Israel the absolute necessity of obedience to all of God's commandments. And if they did not, God would not bless them. I mentioned in verse number 10, this phrase where it says by foot, where the land of Egypt watered their land by foot. Here's a comment from the Understanding Bible Commentary series. May refer to foot pumps used to lift water from the river, the Nile River, and canals to the fields. And that's the way that Egypt took care of their crops. Remember, we've talked about this in the Bible study series in the past, that there was a lot of famine back in the ancient world. If you remember back in Genesis chapter 12, Abram had to flee to the land of Egypt because of a great famine. And peoples in that time would do that because of the Nile River. And they took care of their crops that way. But the promised land of Canaan would depend upon God for the rains. Okay? And that's a contrast here in verses 10 through 12. And I just went through this, but I've got it here on the screen. Egypt is a land of scarce rainfall. They irrigated their crops, described as watered by foot, where they opened and closed irrigation canals from the Nile. So they depended upon human irrigation systems, Egypt did. But the contrast is Canaan is a land without a major river. It depends upon the regular rains, the rain from heaven. And the blessing of the rain from heaven upon Israel would come upon their obedience. And that's what's being stressed here. And, of course, lessons that we can draw from that. God blesses us for obedience. And also things can go bad for us for disobedience. Okay, continuing on now. Verse number 13. And it shall be that if you earnestly obey my commandments, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. Notice how many times this is repeated to the new generation in this sermon by Moses. Verse 14, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season. The early rain and the latter rain, talking about the autumn rains and the spring rains, that you may gather in your grain, your new wine and your oil. And I will send grass in your fields for your livestock, that you may eat and be filled. And this is probably one of those sections in Moses' sermon when he's describing this to the new generation, which they only knew manna. That's what they lived on. And the description of the rains, of the new wine and the oil, abundance of crops. They were probably salivating when they heard this. But there's a warning as we continue on in verse 16. Take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. That was going to be a great temptation that could happen. Lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you, and he shut up the heavens so that there be no rain, and the land yield no produce, and you perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you. So we see here in verses 13 and 14. For obedience, God promised rain in due season, the autumn rains and the spring rains, to provide grain, wine, and oil. Now, the promised land, when we think about it, is a physical type of the wonderful promises God makes of the world tomorrow, the kingdom of God, the blessings and the abundance that will be there. Finally, when this man's rule will be put under, Jesus Christ will be ruling from Jerusalem, we'll finally have peace upon this planet, and abundance will take place, and God will bless us. And again, this gives us a snapshot of that. In verse number 16, though, there's a warning to the new generation not to worship other gods in regards to the agriculture. The Canaanites were famous for attaching the abundance of their agriculture with their pagan gods. The Canaanites worshiped Baal, who was the god of rain, the god of agricultural production and fertility, with his other consorts. And Israel was warned not to succumb to that type of worship, or God would cut off their rain. And that's what was being stressed in this particular section. The next section that we come to, verses 18 through 25, is a summary of what Moses had covered earlier in his sermon. Verse number 18. Therefore you shall lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul. Bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. This is a metaphor for all the time living God's way of life, keeping his commandments, etc. Verse number 19. You shall teach them to your children, speaking of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. And if people were doing that in the world today, we'd be living in a better world. Verse number 20. And you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates, that your days and the days of your children may be multiplied in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers to give them, like the days of the heavens above the earth. This particular section here now, verse number 18 through 20 is a repetition of words going back to the Shema of chapter 6, verses 6 through 9, with a slight variation. Tyndale commentary adds this: the repetition of this passage at both ends of this long section, this sermon, therefore serves as a warning of the danger of embracing Canaanite gods. It also renews Israel's call to love, fear, and serve the Lord alone by teaching and keeping his commandments in the home, when on a journey, and in public life. In other words, all the days of one's life. And we see this phrase in verse number 21, like the days of the heavens above the earth. The Jewish Study Bible Tanakh translates this, as long as there is a heaven over the earth. And I like this very good comment by the parallel commentary. It says this: this is the basis by which Israel will one day occupy the land during the kingdom age. The promise of the land continues forever. God's promises stand forever. Continuing on now, verse number 22. For if you carefully keep all these commandments, which I command you to do, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and to hold fast to him, then the Lord will drive out these nations from before you, and you will dispossess greater and mightier nations than yourself. Verse 24. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads shall be yours, from the wilderness and Lebanon, from the river Euphrates, even to the western sea, shall be your territory. And eventually under Solomon, he would reign over a great expanse of territory like this. Verse number 25, no man shall be able to stand against you. The Lord your God will put the dread of you and the fear of you upon all the land where you tread, just as he said to you. And again, God would take care of those mighty people, the fortified cities, if Israel would trust and obey him. Here's a very good comment from the Understanding Bible Commentary series. Before the Israelites could begin to enjoy agricultural success in the land, they had to have military success so as to actually settle there. These verses hang Israel's possession of the land upon the condition of faithful obedience. Repeating the message of chapter 7, verses 12 through 24. One more section here in chapter 11, verses 26 through 32, is a mini-blessing and cursing section. Now, eventually, when we come to chapter 27 and 28, those are two complete chapters of blessings and cursings. Here we have a little mini-section of them, an initial reciting. Verse number 26. Behold, I set before you today a blessing and a curse. Decisions to be made. And likewise, we have decisions to be made before God as well. The blessing, verse 27, if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today. Verse 28, and the curse, if you do not obey the commandments of the Lord your God, but turn aside from the way which I command you today, to go after other gods which you have not known. Verse number 29. Now it shall be, when the Lord your God has brought you into the land which you go in to possess, that you shall put the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. This is talking about markers that they would actually place on these mountains as a reminder of the blessing and the cursing. Something like what we have today in historical markers where you can look and read some piece of history. There were actual markers to spell out the blessing and the cursing on these mountains. Verse 30, are they not on the other side of the Jordan toward the setting sun in the land of the Canaanites who dwell in the plain opposite Gilgal beside the terebinth trees of Moreh? Verse 31, for you will cross over the Jordan and go in to possess the land which the Lord your God has given you, and you will possess it and dwell in it. Verse 32, and you shall be careful to observe all the statutes and judgments which I set before you today. And again, a little mini section of the blessing and cursings. Blessing for obedience, cursing for disobedience. A comment from the Understanding Bible Commentary series. These verses have a present and future aspect, where God says, I set before you today a blessing and a curse. All the teaching and preaching of the previous chapters focus on these alternatives. These verses also point to the future and the need for a permanent reminder. So Moses arranges for a physical monument to the covenant alternatives, two mountains. Gerizim and Ebal are mountains on either side of Shechem, a place associated with a significant covenant ceremony, eventually Joshua chapter 24. Gerizim symbolizing the blessing and Ebal the curse, an actual marker set up to remind them of the blessing and the cursing. That's the end of chapter 11. One more chapter we'll cover here today, chapter 12. Chapter 12 is concerned with the exclusive worship to God in contrast to the pagan gods. And it reflects the first two commandments. The first two commandments, that you to have no other gods before me and to make no graven images. This particular chapter reflects those two first commandments. Verse number one. Oh, and also, this begins the second part of Moses' second sermon in chapter 12. A long sermon that was being given to the children of Israel. Okay. Verse number one. These are the statutes and the judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. And notice verse number two. And this is a command from God. You shall utterly destroy all the places. And notice I have in dark letters the word places on the screen. That's my emphasis. You shall utterly destroy all the places. In other words, the pagan sanctuaries, where the nations which you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. The pagans like to set up their sanctuaries, especially on the high mountains, and a lot of times that was done in the ancient world to try to get up as high as they could to worship the sun and the moon, which they worshipped, and also in the groves of the green trees. And people still do that today, using green trees in worship. So God tells them to utterly destroy these places. Okay? The phrase is, in verse number 2, destroy all these places. And they were to destroy them because they had special religious significance in the pagan ceremonies and their worship. And the physical act of destruction would be symbolic of the rejection of their gods. And they'd learn lessons as they would go through destroying their pagan sanctuaries, that they are to worship God and not what has been set up. Here's a comment from the New International Commentary of the Old Testament about the sanctuary's locations that they set up. It says this: some shrines were located on high mountains and hills. The mountain or hill was thought to be the home of a god, and by ascending the mountain, the worshiper was in some symbolic sense closer to the deity. And as I explained, quite often to worship the sun and the moon to get closer to them. Continuing on, there were also shrines located under every green tree. Certain trees were considered sacred and symbolized fertility. The nature of the worship was characterized by altars, pillars, standing stones symbolizing the deity in some manner, asherim, which was a tree or a wooden pole, symbolizing the fertility goddess, and images of their gods. And these were the things that they were to destroy. Continuing on, verse number 3. And you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, burn their wooden images with fire. You shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy their names from that place. Now notice again, if you can see the screen, that I've got in dark letters, that's my emphasis, their names from that place. And that was important because the Canaanites had cities and their places named after their gods. Baal, such and such. And I've got some coming up to show you. Also, they attached Ashtoreth with some of their cities' names, etc. And God says in verse number 4, you shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. Okay, let me explain this a little bit further now. This phrase, destroy the names from that place. Let's take the name Baal. The name Baal. Here's from the International Encyclopedia of Biblical Information. It says this: as the word in Hebrew also means possessor, Baal means possessor, it is quite possible that when used in a religious sense, the name signified the god of a particular area of land or soil. Thus, the forms under which Baal was worshipped were necessarily as numerous as the communities that worshipped him. They were all over the place, in other words, these place names. Each locality had its own Baal, or divine lord, who frequently took his name from the city or place to which he belonged. Here's some of them on the screen: Baal Hazor, Baal Hermon, Baal Meon, Baal Peor, just to name a few of them. And also Ashtoreth, the goddess Ashtoreth, had names of cities named after her attached with their cities as well. And God was saying to destroy the names from that place. Okay, let's continue on now. Actually, let's go back to verse number 4 again, where God says, you shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. Verse 5, but you shall seek the place which the Lord your God chooses, in contrast with the pagan place names and sanctuaries. You shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses out of all your tribes to put his name for his dwelling place, and there you shall go. Okay? So in contrast with the pagan place names, you should go to the place where God chooses and where his dwelling place would be. And what's his dwelling place? The tabernacle and the ark, and later on the temple that Solomon would build. That's where they are to go to worship. That's where his name would be placed. Okay, going back to verse number 4 and 5 here. Israel was to stay away from the places of Canaanite worship and go to the place that God would choose. This phrase, the place where the Lord your God chooses, is mentioned 7 times in this chapter. 7, which is symbolic of completeness, mentioned 7 times in this chapter, in verses 5, 11, 13, 14, 18, 21, and 26. But also, the phrase, the place where the Lord your God chooses, and if you're reading in the King James Version, it's shall choose, is used 19 times in the book of Deuteronomy. So God is making it emphasized that you are to go to the place that God chooses. Here's a comment from the Nelson Study Bible. The central place of worship was God's to choose. God blesses his people with his presence in the tabernacle in the wilderness, later at Shiloh, in the temple in Jerusalem, and finally through Jesus Christ. I thought that was a very good comment. The place that God would choose. I've got a couple more. I think this is such an important phrase here. The place that the Lord your God chooses. Let's look at a couple more. Let's see here. Come on. A couple more comments here. This is from the Understanding Bible Commentary series. This expression denotes the presence of the tabernacle and the ark, the visible symbols of God's presence in the midst of the people. Remember, that's why the tabernacle was built. God wanted to dwell with his people. And later on in the temple that Solomon would build. The combined expression, the place of the Lord's choice, and the place where he puts his name, or either part of it, become the standard designation throughout the rest of Deuteronomy for the legitimate sanctuary. God's choice where he puts his name. The priority of the text, which is concerned not so much with the location of the place as with its election by God. Not so concerned about the location, but its election by God. What matters is not where, but who. Likewise, the Canaanite sanctuaries were to be destroyed, not because of where they were or because where they were many, but because of their names, i.e., whose they were. So, not so important where, but who. Who is being worshipped? God is being worshipped. And you know, that's true for us today. You know, we look at Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 22 and 23, which we'll get into in the next Bible study, where God says about the Feast of Tabernacles, to go to the place where he chooses. But you know, there are some people, because of health issues, you know, some that are in wheelchairs or some that have grave health issues or whatever, and even this year with the COVID-19, because of things that are happening, won't be able to go to a certain place for the Feast of Tabernacles. However, they're worshiping God, God who is the one that they worship, with their study, their meditation, thinking about the kingdom of God. God recognizes that they are worshiping them, and he accepts their worship. And so where they are at in their place, they are worshiping God. And that's what God wants from his people. Okay, I got a little off track there. But again, it's not so much important about the location as with the election by God. One more comment here about this phrase, the place where the Lord your God chooses, this time the Bible Knowledge Commentary. The place where the Lord your God chooses. That is, he would choose a site for the tabernacle, the place where God and the people would meet. This command did not mean that the tabernacle would always stay in the same place, for it was moved at God's command. The ultimate fulfillment of this command came centuries later when God let David move the tabernacle to Jerusalem where his son Solomon built the temple. And again, this is being stressed to the new generation that you are to worship the place where God chooses, not in the places of the Canaanite sanctuaries. Okay, continuing on now, coming to verse number 6. There you shall take your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings of your hands, your vowed offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herds and flocks. Remember, we talked about in Leviticus the way that the people of Israel worshiped God was through their sacrifices. The way that they approached God was their sacrifices and their offerings. Verse 17, and there you shall eat before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice in all to which you have put your hand, you and your households, in which the Lord your God has blessed you. This is festival language. You know, rejoicing at the Feast of Tabernacles, rejoicing on God's holy days. Going back to verse number 6, this phrase, there you shall take your sacrifices and your offerings. And this was being stressed to avoid sacrificing to the Canaanite gods. Remember, the new generation had already succumbed to this. Numbers chapter 25, the god of Baal of Peor, where the Moabite women mingled amongst them and convinced them to sacrifice to their gods, and they worshipped the god of Baal of Peor. They had already succumbed to that. And God is warning them to avoid the sacrificing to the Canaanite gods. Verse number 7, eating before God is a way of worship, along with rejoicing in the bounty that he provides. Understanding Bible Commentary Series says this, eating and rejoicing are not just permitted, they are commanded. And that's what we do when we go to the Feast of Tabernacles. When we get together with family and friends and we eat a nice fine meal, we are picturing the rejoicing and the abundance that will take place in the kingdom of God, and rejoicing as we partake of those meals. Continuing on now, verse number 8. You shall not do as we all are doing here today. A better translation would be have done, particularly with the new generation, going back to Numbers 25. Every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes. And of course, they did sacrifice to the god to Baal of Peor in that particular incident. Verse number 9, for as yet you have not come to the rest and the inheritance which the Lord your God has given you. Verse 10, but when you cross over the Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies round about, so that you dwell in safety, then there will be the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. There you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings of your hands, and your choice offerings which you vow to the Lord. Again, their way to approach God in worship. Going back to this phrase in verse number 8 where it says to do whatever is right in his own eyes means to sacrifice wherever one pleases. And again, the Moab incident, going back to Numbers 25, is a perfect example of that. That they are to worship in the place that God chooses, not in the pagan places. Here's a comment from the New International Commentary of the Old Testament about verse 10. It says, verse 10 is a further word of encouragement to persevere in faithfulness to God in the events lying ahead, that they would dwell in the land, rest from your enemies, and dwell safely. Encouragement to the new generation. And the place that we read in verse number 11, or if you're reading in the King James Version, it's simply a place, and that's referring to the Ark of the Covenant, that would, as the Companion Bible puts it, the Ark of the Covenant would be the place until the temple was built. And God assured them in verses 10 and 11 that after crossing into the land of Canaan, that they would dwell in a safe and secure land, and that he would reveal the central sanctuary where the people could bring their offerings and sacrifices. And one of the places that we do know that was mentioned in the book of Joshua was Shiloh, and that's Joshua chapter 18, verse 1. Okay, continuing on now, verse number 12. And this is festival language, what we're going to read here. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and your daughters, your male and your female servants, and the Levite who is within your gates, since he has no portion nor inheritance with you. So rejoicing again, especially in God's feast days. But there's a warning, verse 13. Take heed to yourself that you do not offer your burnt offerings in every place that you see, referring to the pagan places. Verse 14, but in the place which the Lord chooses in one of your tribes, there you shall offer your burnt offerings, and there you shall do all that I command you. Again, their sacrifices as a way of approaching and worshiping God. I like this comment from the parallel commentary about rejoicing before the Lord in verse 12. It says this, the phrase rejoice before the Lord applies to the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles at the end of harvest, Leviticus chapter 23. Very good comment from the parallel commentary. And verse number 12 emphasizes that the whole household must worship in rejoicing and feasting at the sanctuary, including the servants, and that the Levite is not to be forgotten since he has no inheritance in the land. Here's a comment about the Levites in from verse number 12 from the New American Commentary. The reference to the Levites confirms the view that the community worship was to be undertaken by the community as a whole and in one place. For otherwise, the Levites and others could officiate at services in the various towns of their allotment. And verses 13 and 14, whoops, sorry about that. Verses 13 and 14. Come on here. Lost it. Verses 13 and 14 emphasizes the principle that sacrifices could only be brought to the place that God chooses. Now, this brings up this section that we just read, a change in legislation that was brought about here in the book of Deuteronomy about the slaughter of domesticated animals for food for the people that's going to be addressed in the next section. Okay, and I'll explain. We're going to go back here to the book of Leviticus about previous legislation that was given at Mount Sinai. Now, let me refresh your memory. Back at Mount Sinai, the children of Israel, when they were receiving instructions in the book, what's written in the book of Leviticus about the sacrifices, they were being fed by God with manna. The few animals that they had were set aside for sacrifices. They didn't have an abundance of animals, and they were set aside for sacrifices. But when they did sacrifice, it had to be at the tabernacle. They could not do it outside the camp, and that was stressed. So now Israel is going to be coming into the promised land. They're going to be spreading out throughout the land, and there's going to be a central sanctuary somewhere. So what about if you've got animals, which eventually they'd have flocks and herds, abundance, and you want to just have a meal for your family from your animals? So new legislation had to be brought about to kill animals just for food rather than bringing them for sacrifices. Okay, the previous legislation is in Leviticus chapter 17, verses 8 and 9. You shall say to them, whatever man of the house of Israel or the strangers who dwell among you who offers burnt offering or a sacrifice, verse 9, and does not bring it to the door of the tabernacle of meeting to offer it to the Lord, that man shall be cut off from among his people. So there was a warning there as well, that if you are going to sacrifice an animal, you have to bring it to the tabernacle. And that's because they were in the wilderness and they had very few animals. They were set aside for those sacrifices. Had to be brought to the tabernacle, or you could be cut off from among the people. So now new legislation has to take place. I've got a comment from the New International Commentary, the Old Testament, about this, what was written in Leviticus. It says this, this law could be effective only when eating meat was a rare luxury and when everyone lived close to the sanctuary as during the wilderness wanderings. You know, they were all together in the wilderness wanderings. After the settlement, it was no longer feasible to insist that all slaughtering be restricted to the tabernacle. And that's what this wilderness legislation was about, that any slaughtering had to be done at the tabernacle because those animals were reserved for sacrifices. Now we've got a different situation, and new legislation comes about. And that's what we come to in this next section, beginning in verse number 15. Distinctions when Israel settled in the land and they begin to spread out. Okay, verse number 15. However, you may slaughter and eat meat within all your gates, the cities and the settlements that they would spread into, whatever your heart desires, according to the blessing of the Lord your God, which he has given you. The unclean and the clean may eat of it, talking about ceremonially clean or unclean, of the gazelle and the deer alike. So if you're going to have a family roast, you can do that within your cities and your gates where you have spread out to among the land. Of course, the clean animals that had already been instructed to them, going back to Leviticus chapter 11. Verse 16, only you shall not eat the blood. You shall pour it out on the earth like water. We talked about that in the book of Leviticus, that the blood, there's life in the blood and symbolizes the life, and that's why it was to be poured out on the ground. Comment from the Bible Knowledge Commentary. Wild game animals and animals acceptable for sacrifice could be eaten without taking them to the central sanctuary as long as they were not slaughtered for offerings. So if you had taken an animal and set it aside and said, this is going to be my sacrifice to God, you couldn't slaughter it at your home or in your city. That had to be taken to the sanctuary. But if you're just slaughtering it for family use, eat, very fine. Okay, continuing on. Such an animal was not intended for sacrificial worship, nor did it matter whether the partakers of the meal were ceremonially unclean or clean. Another comment from the New International Commentary of the Old Testament about the blood. The blood was to be treated with respect, regardless of whether the slaughter was carried out in a secular or ritual setting, because the blood symbolized life, that which God imparted to all living creatures. And again, this new legislation is being brought out because they're going to be in a different situation, spread out throughout the land, and there's going to be times when they're going to want to eat their meat, and as long as it's not set aside for sacrifice, they were free to have their family meal. Okay, continuing on now, verse number 17. I'm going to take a drink of water here real quick. Verse number 17, you may not eat, notice the not, you may not eat within your gates, the cities where you live, the tithe of your grain, or your new wine, or your oil, or the firstborn of your herd, or your flock, or any of your offerings which you vow, of your free will offerings, or of the heave offering of your hand. If it's been set aside for God, you don't touch that. Verse 18, but you must eat them before the Lord your God in the place which the Lord your God chooses. You and your son and your daughter, your male servant and your female servant, and the Levite who is within your gates. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God in all to which you put your hands. Verse 29, take heed to yourself that you do not forsake the Levite as long as you live in the land. So we see here for the second time in this particular chapter, here in verses 12, going back to 12 and verse 13 previously, that Moses warned that anything that was intended for the worship of God could only be eaten at the central sanctuary where God would place his name. And the Levite was not to be forgotten either, reflected in verse number 19, as the people were to provide for them. Okay, we're winding down here now. Verse number 20. When the Lord your God enlarges your border, as he has promised you, and they begin to spread out throughout the land, and you say, let me eat meat, because you long to eat meat, You may eat as much meat as your heart desires. But again, not an animal set aside for worship. Verse 21, if the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far from you, then you may slaughter from your herd and from your flock, which the Lord your God has given you, just as I have commanded you, and you may eat within your gates as much as your heart desires. Verse 22, just as the gazelle and the deer are eaten, clean animals, so you may eat them. The unclean and the clean, ceremonially we're talking here, may eat them, alike may eat them. Verse 23, only be sure that you do not eat the blood, for the blood is the life. You may not eat the life with the meat. You shall not eat it. You shall pour it on the earth like water. You shall not eat it, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. Comment from the Bible Knowledge Commentary. The permission to eat meat, not intended for use in worship, was repeated here, but with some added details. The earlier prohibition, Leviticus chapter 17, against eating meat without offering it first at the tabernacle, was only meant to apply while the Israelites were in the wilderness, when their homes were near the religious sanctuary, the tabernacle. Now the people were about to move into the promised land, where the majority would live too far away from the central sanctuary to bring meat there. So permission was given to slaughter and eat animals at home for secular meals. So that sums up what we've been talking about here. And in verse 22, we find the person who was ritually unclean could not partake of a sacrifice, but they could participate in the family roast. Remember, if a person was ritually unclean, they could not bring their sacrifice before God in the tabernacle. But when they're spread out in the land and they're having a family meal, that didn't matter. Okay. We've just got two more sections to deal with and we'll be done with this chapter. Verse 26. Only the holy things which you have in your vowed offerings you shall take and go to the place which the Lord your God chooses. We see that phrase over and over again seven times in this chapter. And you shall offer your burnt offerings, the meat and the blood, on the altar of the Lord your God. And the blood of your sacrifices shall be poured out on the altar of the Lord your God, and you shall eat the meat. Verse 28, observe and obey all these words which I command you, that it may go well with you and your children after you forever, when you do what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God. Okay, we got a comment from the Understanding Bible Commentary series. Any food, however, animal or vegetable, that was specifically offered to God in tithe, firstborn, or any other reason, must be properly brought to the sanctuary. And again, reemphasizing what I've already been talking about. And this phrase in verse 27, the blood of your sacrifices, again, the same commentary. In ordinary butchery for food, they were to pour it, the blood, out on the ground with no atoning significance. But the blood of your sacrifices shall be poured out on the altar where it made atonement. Again, that was a ceremony to be done at the altar. One more section here now, verses 29 through 32. This particular section ends with the avoidance of pagan practices. Verse 29, when the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go in to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their God, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise. They weren't even to even ask about how they were worshiping their gods. Verse 31, you shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. For every abomination to the Lord which he hates, they have done to their gods. For they burn even their sons and their daughters in the fire to their gods. That's how terrible it was. Child sacrifice. Verse 32, whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it or take away from it. Strong admonition from God. Okay, one more comment here. Moses cautioned Israel to be careful not to worship like the pagans. First of all, their curiosity would cause them to become ensnared by it. And secondly, the abominations were detestable, including child sacrifice. That brings us to the end of chapter 12. But as we always do, let's talk about some lessons. I've been talking about some along the way, but let's talk about some more here before we end. Whoops. Okay. Lessons were learned from the mistakes that took place at the golden calf incident and other incidents. And we make mistakes also, and we learn lessons as we travel through this life. But we have to remember what God said to the new generation. After we learn those lessons, what does God require of you? To walk in His ways, to be obedient, etc. Okay, actually I've got that on the screen here. From these lessons, what does God require you? And here's the scripture. To fear the Lord your God, to walk in all His ways, to love Him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments of the Lord, His statutes, which I command you today for your good. Lessons learned from the mistakes, but walk with God. Another lesson is God requires exclusive worship to Him. There's a danger in compromise with paganism. It turns one's heart away from the true God. And that's what happened in the first century AD to the true church. And things have been going on that way throughout the centuries. But God requires true worship to Him. That brings us to the end of the Bible study. So we'll go ahead and close the service today with a final hymn and closing prayer. And I look forward to chatting with many of you after services, and maybe a few of you as well that are connected here by the internet.